You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 44. I totally forgot what my opening line is. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, a podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey. Today, I have a special guest, Matt Odell. We are recording live in beautiful Astoria. We are, I guess I shouldn't say live, we're in person, because I don't know when this is going out. But anyways, Matt, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, so Matt is a co-host with Marty Bent on Rabbit Hole Recap. If you guys don't listen to that, you should be. And you recently released Final Message, which is pretty cool. We'll get into that later. And what's your origin story? Like, how did you get into Bitcoin, and what is it to you?
You know, I had two friends tell me. About 6 months apart from each other. And the first friend I dismissed. And when the second friend told me, and he was a completely different type of person, I was like, maybe there's something here to it. And I think we see that a lot where you have almost everyone's first reaction to discovering Bitcoin is, oh, well, you know, well, that can't last or that can't work. And then they see it again for some other reason. And they're like, well, it's still there. Why is it still there? So that happened for me in like 2012-ish. But I didn't actually really jump in until 2013. It just resonated with me politically from a tech angle and from a political angle. I happened to be both, relatively obsessed with like politics and game theory, but at the same time with technology. So I checked off every single box, and I guess I was also kind of like a pessimistic youth, and it gave me hope, you know, and I find that a lot. I mean, a lot of our society today is just super pessimistic, especially the younger generation, on both sides of the political spectrum. And I kind of just like roll my eyes at them, and I'm like, well, got Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, for sure. I had been told about Bitcoin, but like I said, I'd kind of put it off and I'd kind of forgotten about it. I had other things going on in my life, and then I discovered libertarianism. And as I was learning about that, and kind of that was a mind blowing thing, I read For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard, and it really kind of blew my mind. I'd always been very conservative and kind of opened up and showed all the like certain like the hypocritical side of like being for small government, but also being for like this big military presence and all these things. And so as I was going through that, then I became very pessimistic. You know, I'd kind of been disenchanted with a lot of conservative politics anyways, for saying things and then not following through on them. When I found Bitcoin, it was like, oh, okay, this, or when I kind of re-examined Bitcoin after having that libertarian lens, and it was like, oh, this makes sense, because now we have, and it's nice because now we have something we can build instead of just being mad and wanting to tear down the things that exist.
It's productive.
Yeah, exactly.
It's pretty crazy. Yeah, that was basically my realization, is that, you know, you can't just magically like fix all the evils of the world, but you can build tools that do make a difference. So in a lot of ways, I kind of feel like the ideology I was looking for the whole time was cypherpunk, but I just didn't even realize it until after Bitcoin.
Yeah. So what you said politically, what would you have considered yourself before that?
You know, I went back and forth, you know, I would say like mostly libertarian. I just, it was, you know, I basically, my formative years was 2008, was seeing the whole 2008 financial collapse.
Where were you? I don't know.
I was in school. Okay. I was in my freshman year of college.
Okay.
And I just watched like all these people who they were supposed to know everything.
Right.
And they clearly had no fucking idea what was going on. It wasn't even like, let's, who to blame. I was just looking at it like, oh my God. I thought that there was like a group of people called adults that like when you grew up, like you became an adult and you like knew how things were supposed to work and how they would work properly. And then I just realized, I was like, they're just making it up as they go along. They have no fucking idea what the hell's going on. So I developed like a very much a fuck the man type of attitude. And I just really like, you know, hands off approach, free market, that type of thing.
Cool. Cool. So, I mean, you kind of already answered this, but you know, after I had an interview back in January with Alex Hardy, and he kind of brought up the, the parable of the, like the elephant and all the blind people, right? And they each grab a different part, and it's, you know, different things to different people. So like, what is Bitcoin to you? Like, what are the most important properties or the things that you focus on, I guess?
I mean, I think that it's the best money that we've ever had. And I think the implications of having a money that is as good as Bitcoin are far reaching and frankly, absolutely insane. Like the difference that having a truly fair money that no one has, no specific individuals have control over. They can't use it to oppress anyone. They can't use it to basically like take their money. We've just never seen anything like that. And we have that in front of us. And then people get distracted by all the other bullshit that surrounds it. While we have this one thing here that is just going to be absolutely transformative.
Yeah.
Just the free movement of money around the world and no one can stop it. It's just absolutely, it's just hard to even fathom.
So, I mean, I don't want to get too into it, but when you're saying people getting sidetracked, I feel like you do a good job of not getting caught up in the drama. Maybe I'm.
Yeah, I tried to. I tried to just take a step back. And just try and focus on what's important. Like life is fucking short and it just, you really should appreciate it as much as possible.
Yeah.
And then also at the same time, try and accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, something I admire about you, just from following you on Twitter and, listening to you on Rabbit Hole Recap, you are a very adversarial thinker. Like you, I appreciate that you're always trying to think of like, okay, how do we proactively prevent attacks, or how do we think about these things? Like what shaped that in you? What, like, are there certain things or certain things that you've read or experienced that help you think that way? Or,
well, first of all, like people think, like some newcomers like think like the Bitcoin community, so-called communities, like toxic or whatever. Like back then, back when I started,
screech my chair, sorry.
It was even more so, I would say. Okay. And like they were very, it was very much like a trial by fire, like not your keys, not your coins. Like there's, everywhere you go, there's someone trying to take your money. And it really hardened me in the beginning. But I think the main thing was part of the reason I really jumped into the space was because I lost so much money in 2013, dollar cost averaging, and the price came down on me in that second 2013 run where it went from like 1200 to 300. And I was so young that I was like sitting on like pretty bad unrealized losses. And I said to myself, I was like, I have to learn everything about this thing. Because I'm so invested, like know your investment. You should always know your investment. Right. And that had already been hounded into me as like a young kid by both my dad and my grandfather, like know your investment. And I kind of didn't do that in the beginning, but I was like, I have to. And part of that line of thinking was I immediately saw the value prop of Bitcoin as like a, almost like a black market money.
Yeah.
I knew the people in the powers that be like wouldn't just let it go by easily. So part of that due diligence was me constantly trying to workshop how I would take down Bitcoin if I was in their position, and weighing that into basically like my risk reward model. And I had to say that they haven't been nearly as savvy as I ever expected. You know, like I completely overestimated them.
Yeah.
I thought at this point, like Bitcoin ownership would be illegal in America. I thought like self-custody would be illegal. Like you'd have to keep it maybe in like a Circle account or something and have it fully disclosed and you can't take self-custody. And
yeah. Yeah. I've heard you talk before about you're waiting for that Trump tweet. You think if things had gone the other way, there would be more regulation?
Yeah, I don't think we would have hit the 2017, $20,000 top. We might not have even gotten like CME futures or anything.
Really?
Yeah, because Hillary was like that. She's really good at regulating things and like teaming up with bankers and stuff. Well, instead, Trump got elected and everyone's just super distracted. You know, he doesn't really know what he wants to do. No one else is going to focus on Bitcoin while they're freaking out about everything else.
Yeah.
So it just created this whole nice cover for us. And these years are like our formative years. It's like it's super important to like really get entrenched. And like the more rich people in America that own it, it becomes so much less likely that they can do anything.
Yeah.
With real teeth.
I think that's something that people forget is like every government agency, right, is not this monolithic mind, right? It's made up of individuals who are all self-interested as well. And so some of them are going to get Bitcoin. Hopefully,
some of them already have Bitcoin.
Well, right, probably. Right. Yeah, some of them already have Bitcoin. And so once they own it, then they're not going to want to have it taxed or you know, regulated or whatever as well.
Or banned or yeah. Whatnot. And they're actually inclined to do the opposite. They're inclined to try and pump it, basically.
Yeah.
Every single person who owns it is like a decentralized shill fest.
Yeah, right. Right, we want to pump our bags, but at the same time, it's not. And people accuse Bitcoiners of wanting to pump their bags, and I guess that's true, but it doesn't hurt other people when you pump your bags. Because it's not like you're getting ready to dump it.
Yeah. I think there's two elements to it. I think it's important that you own it, right? So like people know I own Bitcoin, so at least you know I am talking my book, right? So it's disclosed ownership. Which by the way you can enforce. So like there'll be people that'll be basically promoting Bitcoin and we'll pretend they have no Bitcoin, and there's no way, for the first time in history, it's really hard to to enforce those disclosures. So that should be interesting. And then I think the second thing is like Bitcoin has matured at this point and it's way more liquid of a market. So like me tweeting out stack sats is not moving the market up. But if you're tweeting out like an illiquid shitcoin, you know, then you could easily pump the price up.
Yeah, I can see that.
And especially if you combine that with like not disclosing it, and usually with lies and lack of trade-offs and stuff, I think is where the change happens. And I think Bitcoiners are pretty good about bringing people in line who promote Bitcoin under false pretenses. Like we're pretty good about talking about the trade-offs and that it's not just a panacea, like everything is just, you know, magic and great.
Yeah.
We're pretty good about talking about where the trade-offs lie. And
so what, like, give me an example of that, what you're saying, calling out, and you don't have to name names. That's not what I'm looking for.
Well, I just called out Pomp the other day. So like Pomp was like, AT&T has added Bitcoin payments through BitPay. Everyone in the world is trying to accumulate Bitcoin. And like AT&T is just immediately converting to fiat, and they didn't have to spend any kind of infrastructure costs because BitPay is probably just handling the whole thing for them.
Oh,
and
they're
receiving fiat. And I'm like, you know, that is, you know, false pretenses. Like there's so many ways to pump Bitcoin without having to resort to just not
Yeah.
You know.
Sure, they're open to it, but yeah, they're not holding it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, I see what you're saying.
And like the altcoin salesman almost always, you know, they're either just straight lies or like borderline.
Yeah.
You know, faster than Bitcoin, more secure than Bitcoin, more decentralized. There's like 3 miners in China that control all of Bitcoin mining. Like they almost always resort to either directly saying the lies themselves or promoting people that say it around them to give them a shield.
Right, right. Yeah, I got a couple of those Nick Carter FUD dice if we want to roll them and just...
There you go. I love those dice.
All right, let's see what else. So what do you think... I mean, not that we want to give anybody ideas, but what do you think right now are the biggest threats to Bitcoin?
Well, so I mean... It would set us back a little bit if the major countries just like outright banned it. And that's just as easy as just banning it. Enforcement would be difficult, but it would just automatically put us all in the shadows and criminalize like creating companies around it and whatnot.
Right.
The on-ramps, the off-ramps are always a weak spot. That becomes less relevant once we have more money in the system. Then you don't need to go in or out at all, really. I think the mining landscape is in better shape than it's ever been in the past. So that's good to see. In 2017, I was pretty concerned about that. Re-Bitmain.
Yeah, and they kind of blew all their... whatever you want to call it, their lead or their advances on gambling on Bcash.
They went too big, but they didn't go big enough. That's what I like to say. Because like, they didn't try and do the last knife twist. They like went pretty close to it and then...
Yeah, they didn't go all in on...
Yeah,
yeah, they split between...
They should have just went... Like in 2017, they could have went all in on Bitcoin Cash, just switched all their hash rate over, and some interesting dynamics could have happened there. We might have had to change our POW.
You think so?
But they fucked it up anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, the reason they didn't do it is because the game theory dictated that they were too scared to kill their golden goose to do it in the first place.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's more spread out now, I would say, because they fucked up so hard. But that's always a target. But the thing is, with mining... We can move around the world. You can, you know, a lot of these things, you can have jurisdictional arbitrage. You can just...
For sure.
But yeah, I would say, like, I if anything, it's be more concerned as an American than concerned as, like, a Bitcoiner.
Okay.
Because it does kind of seem like we're in a situation here where the only way they could reasonably stop it is if there is, and by they, I mean... world governments, is if there was like global cooperation,
right?
On like a massive scale. I mean, when we're talking, you know, you would definitely need like the heavyweights on board. You would definitely need like the Europeans, Germany, Russia, China, and America. And that they're never going to agree on anything. There's no way that they're going to would be able to do any kind of decisive action, I think.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think what you would do, because in America the biggest regulation is at the on ramps. So I'm just trying to think like what you would do. I mean, I guess you would go to something like Local Bitcoins.
Well, Local Bitcoins requires KYC now.
Oh, that's true.
It would be difficult.
Yeah.
We would have like apps and stuff where you would like meet a stranger.
Yeah.
Ideally, we'd have a couple of more years before we got to that point. You know, that's why every year makes a huge difference, I think.
Yeah.
Because you're basically seeding people out there who have Bitcoin, who could pay you in Bitcoin, who are willing to trade Bitcoin. That's one of the reasons why I think, you know, Bitcoin is so unique in the sea of shit coins, is because it was really born in a time when no one was really paying attention to it. And it had like those years to incubate, relatively free from any kind of, regulatory overreach or hostile actors or anything like that.
If for the listeners, if you guys haven't read Dan Held's, was it Planting Bitcoin series or whatever?
I think it was Planting Bitcoin, right? With the tree on the front.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good series of articles. I'll get the links to that and put it in the show notes. Talking about the timing and stuff. It's not really into the regulatory stuff, but about how he very intentionally, Satoshi very intentionally targeted the Cypherpunk mailing list at a specific time and with the way things were going financially and stuff like that. So y'all should read through that.
There is some interesting, like when you start thinking down the road, I feel like we're like in a little bit of a sweet spot right now, where they are like different countries are trying to scramble to like get their positions almost. They don't want to be left behind, but in a world like 10 years down the road, where Bitcoin's more mature and there's liquid markets all over the place around Bitcoin, we need to make sure that it's distributed enough that like a super sophisticated actor couldn't, you know, take us down. And there's a lot of interesting elements there in terms of, you know, stuff like node counts make you more resistant to like autonomous drone attacks or missile attacks and stuff like that. Because if you could wipe out like a bunch of nodes, you know, and short the network at the same time, there's like all these different interesting implications. But I feel like right now we're like kind of in a more of a game theoretical sweet spot. An EMP would be really bad, but that would just fuck everyone. So
yeah, I mean, it doesn't, how bad is that? I'm trying to think. I mean, I feel like we're way better than we would have been like a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it matters, you know,
I guess how big it was, yeah,
where it hits. But it would just fry all electronics, so
yeah,
pretty much everything would be in fucking chaos.
Yeah, I feel like the scenarios that really put Bitcoin out of commission on a short-term basis even are bad enough that like maybe that's not our issue at that point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like at that point, okay, like whatever, I'm trying to survive.
Yeah, we're in like, what is it, Book of Eli mode, like the post-apocalyptic. Okay, sure, yeah, like Bitcoin's down, okay, then it's, but that's a different conversation.
Yeah, like your money market wouldn't be doing too hot either in that situation.
Yeah. Okay. So the satellite network would still work, I guess. Well, it depends on where they, how high up they detonated.
If it's a solar flare EMP, it could take out the, you know, if it's not like a man-made EMP.
I was thinking man-made solar flare. Yeah. I didn't think
if it's man-made, they could go for the satellites, right?
Yeah.
There's definitely interesting rabbit hole to go down.
Yeah.
That I constantly am going down.
Right. How much time in a day do you spend thinking about these scenarios?
Like at least like 4 hours a week or something. Okay. Like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, most of these other networks are super easy to shut down in comparison, and they haven't done anything there yet, you know? So it's like you kind of, when they start shutting down Tron, when they start going after like the Trons of the world and the Ripples and the, you know, and then maybe the Ethereums, then it's like a canary in the coal mine.
Right.
So they're kind of like, warning signs, and they haven't stopped any of them. So,
yeah. So in that use case, as a canary, then altcoins do serve a purpose.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm one of the few maximalists that, you know, I have no problem with altcoins existing. I think that altcoins are inevitable regardless. Like,
I agree.
It's just what we go back to before, like, why waste your time on nonsense you can't control? Like, I don't think we can argue back and forth whether or not altcoins are moral, but they're going to be there. They're going to be there regardless.
Yeah, people are going to try and make money off copies, so.
Yeah, if you have a free market of money, like, there's going to be a bunch of shitty money. Like, that's, like, how free markets work. And then also, like, in terms of forks, like, anyone can fork. And that's a beautiful part of Bitcoin. Like, that's a really important part of Bitcoin. Like, don't get, like, by all means, and I said it loud and said it proud, that, you know, the Bitcoin Cash fork was going to be worthless and the Bitcoin Gold fork was going to be worthless. But, like, don't get super angry about it.
Right.
Because no one can stop them, and it'll play out exactly as we expect it to play out anyway, because that's how markets work.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that we have a responsibility to at least say something?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Bitcoin Cash specifically is different because that they have the Bitcoin.com brand and stuff like that, and there's been a coordinated effort to basically... Once they start lying and start doing all this stuff, then you really need to... It's like... I mean, Bitcoin would be fine if we didn't call them out. Let's be clear. But the actual end users, you could help some end users if you make a moral stand there. And that's what I tried and do with the pod and with Twitter. And
yeah. Yeah, I agree. That was... And I've said it before, but, like, that's kind of when I came into... Like, I had some Bitcoin before that, but I didn't understand the technical side of it because I had a very rough understanding. But between the Bcash hard fork and between that and 2x is when I was like, okay, like I have to understand this. I need to have a technical knowledge of this so I don't get screwed on these,
like, which forks. Side? Yeah.
So
that's good. From that perspective, it's good.
Yeah, it, like, helped teach you. They serve a purpose, and I think I'm not the only one who had a similar experience of, like, okay, I have to understand this. Like, what is the difference here?
And I think, like, also, like, from the perspective, like, ever since I got in 2013, there was, like, a vocal amount of people who said we had to increase the block size. Now it's categorized as a block weight, but the block size, right away, it had to be done, absolutely, otherwise we were fucked. And because we did have that fork, and the failure of SegWit 2x, I mean, it showed that they were basically like a super vocal minority. Like, the market was very clear by almost every single metric that you could think of, that the Bitcoin chain is the most valuable chain, is the dominant chain, that Bitcoin Cash is worthless, that it's that idea, like, that you just had to do on-chain scaling, like, absolutely right now, it's just all bullshit. And now we can finally, you know, after that, we were able to finally move on and be like, look, you tried.
Yeah.
Market didn't agree with you.
And I think it's good that it happened then, too, because, I mean, from what correct me if you've seen otherwise, but I haven't really seen much resistance to things like Schnorr or whatever. And maybe as it gets closer and we see more details and more specifics, then people will raise concerns. And I think it's good if there are concerns that everybody talk about them. That's not what I'm saying. But, like, I think the people that would be against it for stupid reasons already left.
Yeah, it was like a cleansing process. Almost. And it was purely volunteer based. No one was kicked out. They voluntarily chose to leave.
I was told they were censored.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Censored. Yeah. I don't consider it censorship if you have other channels of communicating your message.
Yeah, I mean, they have plenty of channels. I mean, look, yeah. Only Bcashers would complain about censorship while they control Bitcoin.com, BTC.com, Blockchain.com. Like, are you fucking kidding me?
Right. RBTC.
RBTC. Yeah. They control. It was like, literally, they just didn't control two domains. They didn't control r/Bitcoin and they didn't control Bitcoin.org, and they fucking got their panties up in a bunch.
Yeah. Ridiculous. So. Where was I going to go? We're talking about attacks, like state attacks or, you know, I guess social. I mean, social is, like, on the most legitimate one right now, like, on an individual basis, just like either convincing people to get rid of their Bitcoin or just like causing divides. But as far as network security or things like that, like, yeah,
I mean, that's what SegWit 2x was a social attack.
Yeah.
I was more worried about social attacks until that one failed. I mean, look at everything that we went through about Craig Wright. That alone was a social attack. And I was screaming from the rooftops that Craig Wright was a fraud years ago. And I was really frustrated that so many people in the space basically took his claims at face value and then were promoting it behind the scenes. You know, I remember people were coming back from Satoshi Roundtable last year, their little closed group meeting that they have every year. And they were like convinced Craig was Satoshi. Like some people had, you know, had basically, they were fooled. And at the end of the day, I don't think it really even mattered if I was screaming about him being a fraud or not. Like people figured it out eventually.
Yeah.
You know, like some people got fucked earlier. Hopefully some people didn't get fucked because I was vocal about it. But at the end of the day, like that attack wasn't going to be successful.
Right.
And it was pretty great to see because, you know, we had Gavin, who was like probably one of the most respected Bitcoiners for a while there. Basically like go on a media tour saying that this guy was Satoshi, right? So if that kind of attack can't be successful, then we're doing pretty good.
Yeah. Now what about things like maybe not an outright attack, but something like as things go on, let's say a company wants to pay their employees in Bitcoin and then they say no. You know, for tax collection reasons, they said, you know, well, I guess it's country by country, but let's say the U.S. says, like, oh, you can't pay your employees in Bitcoin. Like, what do you...
I mean, it's like the same threat model as like a ban, right? And I think that the biggest risk of a ban to the end user, well, to Bitcoin, we're good as long as it's not... a global ban,
right?
Then it could get really nasty really quickly. But as long as it's not a global ban for Bitcoin, it's fine. For the end user, the biggest risk is that they didn't get Bitcoin before the ban. Like if I was, whenever these rumors come out, like India's going to ban Bitcoin or China's going to ban Bitcoin for the 25th time,
right?
They're going to ban. If I lived in one of those, or like Mexico now recently, if I lived in one of those countries, like I would absolutely be like FOMO buying like a
right.
motherfucker. Because when it comes time for you to need it, you might not be able to get it.
Right.
And it becomes so much more valuable once it's banned. One of the reasons why I was buying Bitcoin when I was buying Bitcoin in 2013 was because I was like, and one of the reasons why I actually held and I wasn't selling was because I was like, if I sell this Bitcoin and take like a 30% profit, like I might not be able to buy it back.
Right.
I might not be able to do it. So I like really, like you really cherish the Bitcoin you have because you never know. You never know when they could, that's the flip of a switch if they wanted to just ban it.
Yeah. You were talking earlier about using it for black markets and stuff. When it was first explained to me, I immediately saw the value and I didn't understand the technical side of it. But I immediately saw the value because that was, and coming from a conservative background, that was Obama era. And I immediately saw like, okay, if they start banning various guns or whatever.
Yeah, you know, it's super easy. Like, all you have to do is say terrorism.
Yeah.
It's this, you know, all they could, you either, it's, look, it's the ideal money for terrorists. I mean, right now the ideal money is U.S. dollar cash.
Right.
But it's presumably will be the ideal money for terrorists. So they either wait till a terrorist attack happens and, you know, say that they were using Bitcoin to move their money, or you know, they could false flag it relatively easily or fake Bitcoin usage. But whatever,
right.
Terrorist attack happens, they blame it on Bitcoin, child porn, bust ring, blame it on Bitcoin, whatever it is, whatever the evil thing is. And then I think it'd be relatively easy for them to then court that public opinion and basically effectively ban it. But then enforcement, it comes down to enforcement. It comes down to how do you prove that someone doesn't own Bitcoin? It's really easy to prove that you do own Bitcoin if you want to prove it, but it's really hard to prove that you don't own any. You can't prove that you don't own any.
Right.
So the enforcement gets really, really tricky.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think is like best case scenario, worst case scenario, you know, like dystopian major major exchange or major countries ban it. Dystopian versus like hyper Bitcoinization, best case scenario that we can get.
The other attack vector, by the way, that I've kept myself up a lot at night about is if, and I don't think they are, but if they were, if Ledger and Trezor were complicit, I feel like you could probably track the majority of Bitcoin transactions just based on not only do they have customer lists with addresses where people got their hardware wallet shipped to, but they presumably have all your addresses and balances because most people use their software to, they like, you know, check their servers to check their balances. So from a privacy perspective, and also then from the further enforcement, if they were trying to ban self-custody and whatnot, that could be a big central point of failure. Mm-hmm. And it's good that we have things like Electrum Personal Server and Wasabi that are allowing you to use those hardware wallets more privately. And we got to get people to do that now so that they don't have like a big, if they're able to like demask 70% of Bitcoin transactions, and it doesn't even matter if you're in that 70% because they can like connect the dots.
Right. Well, this is, let's go down that track for a second. Like this brings up a good point to, because I was messaging you the other day about it, and I didn't realize. So something like Cash App won't send to a BEC32 address, which stuff like Wasabi is only BEC32. So you've got to go through an intermediary. And so I don't know if everybody knows that, but that's good knowledge. You've kind of got to have a workflow. So
I think Cash App's they're gonna update that shortly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they will. They seem like they've got things together. I saw recently that they're looking for more people to work on their Bitcoin side of things. But
I used Rise Wallet today. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
Peter's been the sponsor on his podcast. It's a voucher system. You buy the voucher card at like a 7-Eleven or something with cash, no KYC.
Really?
And it's pegged for the amount of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the amount of dollars. So like a $25 card. And then when you scan it with the app, it gives you $25 worth of Bitcoin. Whenever you scan it is when it converts. So
similar to what Bedion was working on.
Yeah,
with...
same exact idea. Okay. But it's got a built-in app and the app is non-custodial wallet. So you're never actually giving them custody.
Really?
It's non-KYC and you can send a BEC32.
Nice.
So like products like that will hopefully make private onboarding more possible. So
very cool. Rise?
Yeah, it's called Rise Wallet.
Okay, I'm going to check it out. Very cool.
It's Canada only for now.
Oh, Canada only. Yeah,
I can send you. I'll send you. They gave me a couple of free cards. That's why I tested it. I'll send you a card to test it. It's really
sick.
That's
the same thing with like bills and stuff like that. Yeah. Or like,
and like Budion's is UK.
Yeah.
Like there's another one, Fast Bitcoins, that's UK. But they're actually actively trying to get into America. So we'll see. All this stuff is regulatory bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Like, can they sell $75 to KYC list? Like that is a regulatory arbitrage play. And, you know, as an American, I hope that'll be the case. But also as American, I do not think it will be the case. So we'll see how long it lasts.
Yeah. So you think people who live on border towns will have an advantage there? Like drive across the border, buy the cards, come back?
Yeah, I mean, or drive across the border, get KYC-less Bitcoin, and then sell it for cash.
Yeah.
The Bitcoin directly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's part of what's going to make it so hard to enforce this stuff.
Yeah.
I do think that from like a practical point of view, for most people, you're not giving up that much by going through like a KYC exchange like Cash App, as long as you mix afterwards.
Right.
It's like it's a relatively nice balance. Because let's be honest, like if you want convenience, especially at larger amounts, you need to connect your bank account.
Right.
You're not going to be going to the 7-Eleven to like build a $10,000 position in $25 voucher scratch cards.
Right.
And if your bank account is connected, you're going to have to do KYC. There's just nothing you can do about it.
There's no way around that.
So it's good that we have Wasabi and soon Whirlpool that'll make it easy for people to do coin joins.
Yeah.
And we just need to get everyone to fucking do them, man.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I love about Francis. I don't know how you say his last name.
I'm gonna butcher it too.
Okay, all right.
But
right.
Bolt Bitcoin is his company,
right? So I mean, and he's recently said that he's doing everything through all of his transactions through Wasabi. I look I look forward and hope that like other companies will do similar things with their privacy with either Wasabi or once Samurai gets Whirlpool, you know, out of beta or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I was really excited that he did that because they're like a regulated Canadian company. I expected one of the, like the non-regulated companies to do it first, like a BitMEX or a Binance or someone like that. A big one for us would be Kraken.
Yeah,
and that seems reasonable because Jesse Powell always wants to say "fuck you" to the man.
Yeah, I don't think Jesse listens to the show, but Jesse, if you're listening. Or if somebody has Jesse's ear, yeah.
Don't worry, Jesse. I'll keep poking you on Twitter every week. But yeah, I think I think part of what I've been trying to do with Rabbit Hole is if people get into the flow of when they withdraw from Cash App, when they withdraw from Kraken, when they withdraw from Coinbase, wherever they withdraw from, CoinJoin.
Stop using Coinbase, but yes.
Yeah, I know, but I added that. I added them in there because even if you do use Coinbase, as long as if you CoinJoin afterwards, then not only are you protecting your own privacy by delinking those transactions from your KYC account, but you're also effectively doing exactly what Bull Bitcoin does, but on a person by person basis. Like, we don't need Cash App to necessarily implement it if we can convince 70% of the people that are pulling from Cash App to be mixed anyway.
Right.
Right. You still get that volume, you get that additional liquidity. And like the KYC Bitcoin is seen as like, for whatever it's worth, it's seen as like some of the most legitimate Bitcoin that exists as from the eyes of a law enforcement.
Right.
So we're pushing that into the pool, and it makes the pool seem all that much more legitimate.
Yeah. It gets harder to, I mean, again, enforcement is, I don't know how you enforce, you're going to go house by house and check people's computer for Wasabi wallet, but passing regulation about coin joins or anything like that becomes harder and harder if everybody's doing it.
Well, it effectively becomes a ban on Bitcoin altogether.
Right.
Which is a possibility. Right. But the whole point is that we're designing these systems that even if that does happen, the system should still be good. Individual users might be fucked, especially if they didn't, you know, practice good OPSEC or privacy.
Right.
I mean, I'd probably be fucked if the U.S. government had some kind of ban.
Yeah, your mind names are out there. So.
Yeah. And I just have to live with that one. But I think the system will be fine. And that's the whole point. The whole point is like you shouldn't have to be asking regulators to spare you for the system to continue. Like if you're doing that, then you fucked up somewhere along the line.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's my train of thought.
The Brad Sherman interview was interesting.
I haven't watched it yet.
Because he basically said what we've all said. Like I had a family friend said to me that I should go to graduate school and I should write my thesis on how to properly regulate Bitcoin. And I said to him, I was like, you know, the truth of the matter is they can't effectively regulate it. And I hope they do not realize that. For years, you know, like the ideal situation where they don't realize the scope of what's going on here.
Right. Until it's beyond their.
Yeah. Because it's
abilities. Impossible.
It's like once think about like when you like go to an airport and they ask you if you have more than $10,000 in cash on you.
Right.
And then think about Bitcoin and just laugh yourself to sleep because that's like the most insane thing now. They have no idea. They could strip search you and, you know, cavity search you and they'd have no idea.
Yeah, I hate TSA. Actually, today was my best experience with TSA in a while. I got the least groped.
Our standards are so low now.
I know,
like,
it's really
out,
bad.
You get so happy.
Like I only got a light brush. I didn't even make it to second base. So I considered that a win compared to what I usually get. But yeah. So what do you consider best case scenario? Oh, did we do whatever?
We didn't do. We never did worst case.
We never
case,
did.
Best
we got.
Case.
We
kind of have been talking worst case, right? Well, see, the beauty is that in a Bitcoin world, the worst case is way better than it would be otherwise. I think.
Right.
Like, because the true worst case is, you know, Bitcoin completely fails, And then we have this dystopian future where they're tracking everything we do, absolutely everything we do. And all of our money can just be like switched off at a hat.
They get rid of all cash. Yeah, and everything's it's all digital. Just like digital US dollar.
Exactly. And you fuck with whoever, you know, you might, whatever state you live in. Like they just had the Oslo Freedom Forum. And right. 4.1 billion people live under authoritarian regimes, right? And if you want to loosen that, it's a lot more than that, right? But they were being like more strict about their
definition
of it. But the point is, like, you piss off your state and they just take everything your family's ever had.
Yeah.
And they can surveil you and listen to all your conversations and do all this nonsense. That's the worst case scenario, like a 1984 but on steroids. Like, you know, no one predicted that people were going to be paying for the privilege to have cameras and microphones in their house instead of the government going in and installing them.
Right.
So that on that side is pretty scary. On the utopia, on like the most best case scenario, I think that you separate money from state and all of a sudden you defang a lot of the power and influence that all these countries have over each other. You make it harder for them to raise revenues for warfare. And ideally we would see a more distributed power across the whole world, where you'd have smaller nation states competing in the global marketplace, but the individual states would be like more introspective. They'd be more like socialist almost for their small group of inhabitants that they have in each individual whatever.
You think the United States would ever break up into individual states?
Yeah, I mean, I think that could be super easy. End game in some kind of, I don't know. I think you could see it happening on like a on a softer scale with just like federal power getting weakened. I think like a lot of it becomes a lot harder to justify this like massive central power. When you don't necessarily need it to maintain the full financial world order. Like right now, like if you don't, like the whole world economy basically relies on these mega states and their monetary policies and their policing of the world. But if you take away that specific power and no individual group has control over the money, then maybe we could see a more distributed situation. Like imagine like multi-sig peace treaty bounties and stuff, you know, where if you attack one of your neighbors, like you lose access to the multi-sig.
Mm, yeah.
There could be some interesting plays there where basically because of game theory, all the warfare goes down to more of skirmishes and squabbles. And
yeah, yeah. Well, and this brings up so two things, like kind of inverse of like what was right before World War One, right, where you have all these interconnected treaties that require you to go to war on behalf of other people, and so you've got a couple of countries that get in a skirmish, and now the whole world is at war because they're obligated to come to their defense. But crap, what was my other thing? I'm tired. I've been up since like 3 this morning, had to catch an early flight.
I feel that.
You were talking about...
Yeah, so the treaties bring them all into war, but you could envision a situation where it actually does the opposite, right? Where it ostracizes and penalizes the nations that do... basically give them like a mutually assured destruction, but you do it with their bank account, which is like a Bitcoin multi-sig instead of a situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know where I was going. It's fine.
You know, Bitcoin's money for enemies. So in those kind of situations where you don't need trust in each individual, you can probably do... there's a lot more interesting routes you can go down there than you can with like a traditional peace treaty that might need to be... at the end of the day, has to be backed up by guns. But I mean, like, look, warfare isn't going anywhere. It's just that I think that we can't really, in today's world, you can't really imagine like a more distributed, smaller governance systems where you have like all these different competing city states essentially, because they all need protection. Like you'll just get squashed by one of the big dogs.
Right.
If you step out of line. So when you have a global money, when you have all this, then all of a sudden all these things open up where you have private militaries and you have, you know, private security forces that might be securing multiple countries, you know, multiple city states, but all they do is run an army and they're not actually even a, I don't know, it gets very interesting, yeah. I guess.
Well, maybe that's where I was going, was that as you have less and less in the US dollar to be taxed, to be funneled back in, you have less and less to pay the military. And if you look at these government shutdowns, although, you know, say what you want about Trump, I was kind of surprised that it did go past military payday, which usually the shutdowns don't.
Yeah, that's usually the limit on them.
Yeah, yeah. The politicians will preen and show off until it's military payday, and then all of a sudden they come to a magic solution. So it went a little beyond that this time.
The whole thing is such a spectacle, it just makes me want to buy more Bitcoin every right. time. I think what it comes down to is like, look, nobody knows where any of this shit goes. You know, no one knows. It's humans greatly overestimate their ability to predict what happens in 50 years.
For sure.
But I have a very basic prediction, which is that I think that Bitcoin will still be here. So it puts my mind at ease that no matter what whatever surprises come our way, that wealth will be preserved and carried on to my future generations, right? So yeah. It's like it's an element of insurance there, where before that, any kind of chaos or surprises could just mean that just everything was absolutely lost.
Yeah. So speaking of future generations, I guess that's a good segue for us. Because it's something, I've got kids, and I have to think about that. Like, okay, I got on a plane. I had to think about, okay, like, what do I do if, God forbid, this plane goes down or something happens to us while we're here? And like, you know, there's legal considerations and family and like, who's going to take care of the kids, but also like, who do I want to have access to my Bitcoin, you know, to use that, either liquidate it if it absolutely has to be, you know, if things have to be paid for so that my kids don't carry that debt, or hold it for them for the future. And so that kind of brings us to final message. You want to talk about it a little bit? And like,
well, so I don't have kids yet, but I like came to the same realization. It was 2017 because the price went up way quicker than I expected. And I actually ride a skateboard to and from work. And I was riding the skateboard and I was just like, if something happened to me right now on the skateboard, like 70% of the Bitcoin that I have would just be gone. And it's because, you know, when you start getting paranoid and working through your threat models, if you have like governments in your threat models, the passing it on becomes way, way more difficult. Otherwise, you know, you just, you know, you give a key to a lawyer, you know, you can have, you know, you can trust maybe like a parent or an uncle or something with one key in their safe. But then once you start adding, you know, these more advanced threat models, then like what? Someone comes and tortures them or sees the post-it note on the side of their computer or something like that, right? So
yeah.
So the heirs themselves are risks to the threat model. You know, when you introduce the heirs into the equation, they become risks. So I said to myself, I was like, there's got to be a way to do it where I don't have to trust the heir. You shouldn't have to trust the heir, and I don't have to trust the executor either. And what immediately came to mind was a dead man switch, which I was already pretty much very aware of, but Snowden executed his perfectly. Absolutely amazing that dude never got killed.
Yeah.
And part of the reason was because he presumably had this dead man switch that was going to release all the documents in full if something happened to him. And so I started looking, and I was like, there's got to be a site that just offers just like a simple dead man switch. And it turns out there isn't. And the reason it isn't is because it's mostly used by cypherpunks, and we run our own servers that do it. You know, yeah. You run your own code.
Everybody makes their own.
Yeah. So I was like, I'm just going to make like a super simple dead man switch. I don't have to collect any personal information because payment comes through Bitcoin, and I encrypt it so I don't see it either with a user password. But then at that point, I was still kind of worried because I was operating under the assumption that people would, I guess, you wanted to set it up in ways that even if, because browser-based encryption is browser-based encryption. Like, that's, you know, you shouldn't rely on that for any kind of thing of any kind of value. My thought process was, okay, so you give a loved one, like, an encrypted USB drive, mm-hmm. and then in the dead man switch, you just put the password. Or, you know, you give them half of a seed, and in the dead man switch, you put half of a seed in. But none of those are like really that ideal, and they're kind of easy to fuck up. And I didn't want like new users to fuck shit up and put their funds at risk or possibly lose their funds or stuff. And then over the last 2 years, it's absolutely to untrained eye, they think Bitcoin hasn't changed, but two big things have happened with Bitcoin. Lightning mm-hmm. has absolutely beaten all of my expectations.
Yeah.
And multisig is user-friendly all of a sudden. It was never user-friendly before. So Final Message works really, really well with multisig.
Okay.
Because you can set up to 5 email recipients.
Okay.
Right? So you can do things where, you know, you have like a 3 of 5 key, 3 of 5 multisig, and 2 of your heirs each have their own key. And then the third key gets sent to them through Final Message. So then all of a sudden, Final Message, if I compromise you somehow and like I put like bullshit in the encryption and I'm able to get your stuff, I only have one key, can't do anything about it. The U.S. government forces me to give it to them. I only have one key, can't do anything about it. The individuals each only have one key. They can't do anything about it. And then even when you die, they have to work together with the third key.
That's really cool.
To access the funds. So there's really cool things that people can do. And all I have to provide is a text box. Like yeah. I'm not even, you know, you can just whatever kind of text you want to put in there, you can do. And the power of Bitcoin allows you to do all these crazy things with just that super simple tool.
Yeah. So real quick for listeners who aren't familiar with Final Message, like I'm just going to pull it up and describe what I'm seeing here. It's finalmessage.io.
Correct.
Okay. Sounds like it's raining out there. I just wrote in .com because I wasn't thinking after I said .io.
Yeah, I like the .io domains because they cost more money, so you get the good ones. It's like $40 a year.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's basically like you pick a time frame. Yeah, so you pick a time frame like a month, a week, a month, 6 months, a year. You list up to 5 recipients. Okay, so now this passphrase. Yes. So like if you don't come in and renew it within that time frame,
right?
Then it sends this message out.
To your recipients.
To the recipients.
And it's encrypted. So you have to give the password you encrypt it with on my site, you give to the recipient through another means.
You have to give it to the other recipient. Okay.
Through another means. And I like tried to think of all these complicated ways of doing that. And I was just like, no, it's just just get it to them through another means of way of doing it, and it just adds another layer of security there that I'm not handling that transfer or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, really, when you set up something like this for your heirs, like, you should be explaining to them what's going to go down and stuff anyway,
right,
as part of the process. So basically, the price is $50 per year is what we're testing it at right now. When you pick the smaller time frames, it just scales based on, there's no discount or,
yeah,
or premium.
Yeah,
based on
I noticed
what
that.
You do.
I thought that was neat.
Yeah. And if you actually, you know, the Lightning payments require an invoice. Obviously, so we bill you for this specific time you pick. But if you do on-chain on times of renewal, you can send however much you want and just auto-scale. So, like, you send $75, it, like, adds a year and a half.
Nice.
You send, you know, $2, it'll just add a half week or whatever it is.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
And we put a reminder email there so we can remind you when it's expiring. You can just click the link. But you don't have to give us even the reminder email. And that's the beauty of Bitcoin there. It's like, I saw one other site that offered a dead man switch, and you had to, like, register an account with them, set up an email, like, pay them with PayPal. Like, it's fucking cumbersome. Like, the beauty of this, I have no idea who you are.
Yeah.
If you want it to be that way.
That's nice. So what do you have running as, like, your, how you, I guess, deliver the Lightning invoices and stuff? Because I've used BTC Pay, and I've bought stuff with other people who use BTC Pay, and I've bought things. I did this the other day, and I bought something, and I used Lightning, and just because of the nature of BTC Pay, and if you're using, like, WooCommerce with BTC Pay, it still asks you for, like, a billing address and a shipping address. And I finally sat there and I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna write fake. I mean, I was sending it to, not my physical home address. Was the shipping address wasn't my physical home address, and I used a pseudonym, and then I was like, if I'm paying in Bitcoin, it doesn't matter. So I just filled in more fake stuff, and it worked. It was fine.
Right.
But it's just like, because those forms are there, people just assume that you have to do it.
Right. So we don't even give them the forms.
Yeah.
There's no forms. It just gives you a Lightning QR code or an on-chain QR code. I'm using OpenNode node for this.
Okay.
Which is like what BitPay should have been.
Right.
And then I'm using, for the pod, we're using BTC Pay.
Yes.
You know, the reason I used OpenNode was because my front end dev really liked, you know, how easy OpenNode was. And I also felt like it was kind of nice to experiment with both sides of the story. OpenNode makes it, like, super easy to integrate. And then I don't have to, like, I'm already managing, like, 4 Lightning nodes. I don't have to manage a final message node.
Yeah.
And if we want to switch it in the future, we can, you know, we can switch it really easily in the future.
So,
and OpenNode is nice for us because it does give us some access to fiat if we need easy access to fiat.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what do you recommend people for setting up multisig? Because that's kind of my next step is to look into, I haven't really looked much into multisig.
So for a while I was recommending Electrum. It's still the go-to for, like, best privacy practice. But Electrum has basically become unusable. I mean, you shouldn't, from a privacy perspective, have been using their public servers, but even now, if you don't care about your privacy, like, you can't use their public servers anymore. They're getting DDoS to hell.
Okay.
They don't connect. And, like, people open up their Electrum and they're like, I have no Bitcoin. Where did my Bitcoin go?
Right.
And it's, you know, I was on Stefan's pod and I was talking about how when I first started, I had a site that was like an educational portal. And I used to write guides and guides and guides. And then, like, 6 months later, like, all of them were,
they're all out of date.
They're all out of date. So then I switched to short form, which was Twitter. And now I'm coming back to long form, but it's through podcasts and I don't have to write it down. I like talking way more than I like typing. Electrum was like, I literally guided everyone through Electrum, and I guided them through Electrum with it built into Tails, and they don't make a Debian package for Electrum anymore. So it's not baked into Tails anymore. So So not only do you need to run EPS, like Electrum Personal Server or one of the others like Electris or something like that, you had to sideload it onto Tails. That whole element of my guides were all completely fucked. So ideally, you're running EPS, you know, Electrum Personal Server with Electrum. You do your multisig that way. You use multiple different hardware wallets. Electrum supports a bunch of them. You know, I really like the Trezor and the Cold Card. The Ledger kind of has its place, especially in a multi-sig setting. You're not trusting it as much because the security model for a Ledger is different. You're trusting the proprietary closed chip, but that also means that if they are telling the truth, then physical compromise is a lot less likely than them being able, someone being able to extract the seed from a Ledger, because they have that secure chip. It makes it a little bit more, it makes it more tamper resistant if they are not being malicious. But recently what I've been saying is Unchained Capital has a super easy 2 of 3 multi-sig.
Okay.
And you bring your own hardware wallets to the equation. They have, you can set it up with a Trezor or a Ledger right now, and they're going to add others. And then they have the third key, and the third key is their own special like cold setup, but they only sign once a day. But the main issue with Unchained is they're based in the U.S. and they take some basic ID info.
Okay.
Address, name. I think they ask for a picture of your ID, and they say that. And I've spoken to the guys over there. The team behind it, they're great guys.
Oh yeah, they are. I've had Drew Vaughn before. He's great.
They don't want to ever give that information to the government. Now, the thing is, they could be forced to in the future.
Sure.
But the beauty of it is that they can't take your money because it's multi-sig.
Right. They would only get one.
They would get privacy. They could take your privacy. And also the beauty with Unchained is you don't pay shit unless they sign. If they sign for you, then you pay a percentage of transaction. But up until that point, it's free.
I'm going to have to go back and talk to them about this. I don't think they had this rolled out when last time I talked to them.
Yeah, so it's really slick, really user-friendly. And then the other way to get around that privacy element is if you do use it as more of a cold storage and you coin join before you go in. And when you leave, you coin join. So they just for them, it's just like a black box, right? They'll know how much coins you have stored with them.
Yeah.
Which could be an issue if you're an American and there's like a confiscation act or something where they're taking a wealth tax out of our Bitcoin ownership. And they see, you know, Josh owns this much Bitcoin in Unchained and we know where he lives and we're going to go do it. But if you're not an American citizen, that risk is greatly reduced. Mm. So I think it's like almost, I think it's like a super easy decision to make if you're not an American. Yeah. And then if you are an American, just keep in mind that at any moment, like the U.S. government can know exactly how much is in that account, probably. Mm-hmm. Especially if because I think Unchained is going to end up holding a ton of Bitcoin or holding one key of a multisig for a ton of Bitcoin because it's such a good product.
Right.
And it's so ahead of the game that they'll probably end up being like a relatively big target for the U.S. So just practice good privacy. Use Wasabi in and out. And then the other one is Casa. I don't love Casa's 2 of 3. Because it relies on the app as one of the keys. Mm. So that kind of makes it kind of like feels like that they have control of 2 of the keys if they want to. They have the third key.
Third key.
Then you have one key on a Trezor or a Ledger, and then the other key is on the app.
Yeah.
So they kind of, that second key kind of eeks me out.
Yeah.
But if you do the 3 of 5, you don't have that issue.
Okay.
So, but the 3 of 5 costs money.
Sure.
$1,800, I think.
One time or recurring?
Year.
Yeah.
And it's easier to justify in a bull market. But they're very privacy focused. I think sign up with a NIM and shit.
Oh, wow.
Like, not even, you know, like Unchained treats it as like part of their security model that they want to know their user. But Casa is just like, nope, you can just sign up completely anonymously, pay us in Bitcoin.
Awesome.
And so that's a good method. And then, you know, so then people say to me, should I use Unchained or should I use Casa? And really, you know, use both. Use multiple methods. Like the easiest thing like a non-technical user can do when it comes to storing Bitcoin is to use multiple methods, because you're not reading the code. You have no idea what the fuck is going on.
Right.
So you put it in, you store it multiple reputable ways.
Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah. And if one of them ends up fucking you, like, you still have 60% of your Bitcoin or whatever. And I think it's like such a ridiculous thing to have to say out loud, but that's the truth. Like, so that's like the single best thing you can do is use multiple methods, I would say.
Cool. Let's see. I don't know, man. Seems we're a little over an hour here. What else you got?
You think we're out of the bear market?
I don't know. It'd be nice.
It'd be really nice. It's the easiest bear market ever if that was the bear market.
Well, you know, like, that was... It's the first real one for me that I was paying attention anyways. Like, so I bought a little before the previous one. But like I said, I kind of bought it and then I forgot about it. And I wasn't thinking of it in a huddle type mindset. I was thinking of it in a, stocks trading kind of mindset, and then I forgot about it, and then so I didn't have to live through that, in the sense of, like, I didn't have to, I wasn't paying attention to things, I wasn't, you know, biting my nails like, oh crap, is everything I've put into this gone
in like 2015 or
right yeah. Yeah, I was just kind of like, oh man,
it was just like, what, it was like in cold storage and you just weren't paying attention to it?
No, I didn't have a whole lot, and so I would, you know, check, look at the price every couple months and then be like, oh yeah, okay, whatever, and then move on with my life. And then so then when it started moving up, you know, I kind of looked at it when I saw Lightning got activated, and I went to my buddy and I was like, what's Lightning? Or not Lightning, sorry, SegWit. And I was like, what's SegWit? You know, and then
Lightning was still in the distance at
yeah,
that
yeah,
point.
Lightning hadn't come around. It was like SegWit and then the hard fork, and I was like, what does this mean? And so then I started, and then I, you know, started getting emails. I'll be honest and say it. I got emails from Coinbase saying, like, this is what the, you know, the 2x fork means, you know. And I started
so
looking
bad
at it, yeah. And I was like, wait, what? You know, so then I started learning about it, and this would be my, I guess, second bull run if this bear market's over.
My favorite part of the bear market is when you're like close to the bottom, and if my favorite meme is the what if we're all wrong? You know, like,
yeah.
And you're like with a bunch of Bitcoiners and you turn to them and he's like, but what if we were wrong?
Yeah.
That fear is like one of my favorite, I just embrace that fear is
yeah.
Like the best thing. Yeah, I don't think we really had that as much this cycle.
I don't feel like we had, you know, I hear about the Mike Hearn rage quit. You know,
Most, yeah, in 2015 it was really, I mean, like you say, nail biting. Like I, you know, there was a chance that it was all going to be over, I think.
Yeah.
The Mike Hearn rage quit will always go down in infamy as the best, the biggest rage quit we'll ever
yeah.
have. When he left for R3, and now R3 is like
Jeez.
Nothing. And he went in New York Times and stuff and published it. Like, my dad sent it to me and all these people sent it to me. See, the thing was, the first 2013 run, I was very good Bitcoiner. I had practiced really good OPSEC. I used NIMS everywhere.
Mm.
You know, Bitcoiners were very good about preaching this
yeah.
then. And they're still really, we're still really good about it, I think, but we were especially good back then, and I used NIMS and stuff, and I did it like very discreetly, and I dollar cost averaged it and whatnot. And then, so then the price went down off that first run, and I just kept buying, and I didn't really have the nail biting situation. When we were around like $900, $1,000 in that second 2013 run, I thought I was a fucking genius, you know, like I was super young. I was a fucking genius. And that's when like I bragged to my dad about it.
Right.
And then the whole time going down was just.
So had you not told him before that?
No, I just secretly was just, you know, squirreling away Bitcoin. And so the way down was like extra. I was getting like texts from family and stuff like,
are you okay?
You're destroying your life. Yeah. Are you okay? Is this, you know? And they were, you know, and at that point, everything was drugs and criminals and bad actors. And I remember when Draper bought the Silk Road Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like my dad to this day has this weird infatuation with Tim Draper because he was like the shining light. At the time, he was like the shining light of legitimacy to have this rich, erratic, you know, Californian who was respected in the VC community say that Bitcoin wasn't a complete disaster and that he was willing to, you know, buy all these Bitcoin from the U.S. government at whatever price it was. I think like his second sale was at like $300 he was buying at. He was down 50%. He bought it like 600 on the first sale and then it was like down and he kept buying in the second sale. Yeah. And that was like the first sign of legitimacy that my dad gave to Bitcoin was Tim Draper buying the Silk Road coins. But yeah, I kind of think that this time we were in, if you go by previous cycles, we were due for a harder drop than 3,100. Which is why I caught a lot of like the traders and stuff off guard. You know, a lot of times in the previous cycles, you see them go down to the previous all-time high, which would have been like $1,200, $1,500 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think it just comes down to there's less supply coming every day because of the halvings, right? Than last cycle, there's less supply every day.
Had it happened between that and the 1,200? I don't remember.
Yeah. The halving, 1,200 was like 2 years before the previous halving.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We didn't break 1,200 again until 2017.
Okay, yeah.
And I think we just have a bigger base of both hodlers and dollar cost averagers.
I was going to say, I think there's more people dollar cost averaging.
Yeah, it adds up. Like, imagine just all of us, you know, we're just dollar cost averaging week after week, and it just dries up the supply.
Yeah.
That's already less because of the halving.
Yeah. Well, and it's going to happen again in a year.
Yeah.
It's going to go from one block. It's not like the demand is going to suddenly halve as well. You're going to have a constant or even increasing maybe. Or even if it's decreasing, it's not going to decrease half in 10 minutes.
No.
You know, and all of a sudden the supply is going to be cut in half.
Yeah, and everyone says it's priced in, but it's not. And maybe it'll be more priced in than previous times, and then next cycle will be more priced in, but it's still grossly not priced in because humans are idiots.
Yeah.
And if we really want to go overboard and say, like, all this shit is priced in, then, like, Bitcoin should be trading way higher than it is right now.
Right.
And it's not because there's risk involved and people don't really appreciate. We've never had a planned supply shock where like you knew there was going to be a supply shock to the, especially to this scale where it cuts in half. I mean, they Grayscale just came out and their Bitcoin investment trust is they're accumulating 21% of the Bitcoin mined per month. But this month, the amount of Bitcoin added to the GBTC trust is 21% of the Bitcoin mined. So if their demand just stays flat, which is not going to just stay flat, but if it just stayed flat, it's going to be 42% of the mine supply after the halving. Like, that's like an insane. It gets to a point where you're just like, at some point, something's going to break here and it's just going to...
Yeah, go through the roof.
Yeah, and then I sit to myself and I'm like, you have two situations here, Matt. Like, I'd be disappointed if Bitcoin failed, but I wouldn't be upset with the money I've lost. If Bitcoin succeeds and I sold my Bitcoin and I just watched it like become the global reserve currency or whatever, I don't think I could live with myself. I think I would, you know, if I saw it happening and I just missed it.
But then everybody will be forced onto it, right?
Yeah, I know, but I mean the gains. I mean, I think...
Oh, yeah, yeah, you won't have the gains that you could have had.
You know, people say, like, I'm in it for the tech. Like, I'm absolutely in it for the tech as well, but I'm also in it for, like, life-changing money. Like, I think it's going to be... I think we will see, like, generational wealth families be born out of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice if, like, one of them was an Odell.
Right, yeah. Right. I think in, you know, 50, 100 years, the... you know, Bitcoiners will be the new Rockefellers or whatever.
Exactly. They were just lucky. They were in the right place in the right time when oil was spewing out in California, you know?
Right.
We've seen this so many times in history where like a small group of people make outsized gains because not only are they in the right place in the right time, but they actually are open to it and are willing to take that risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool, man. I wasn't really going to ask this, but this just kind of came to me. What do you, you guys have a pretty good Bitcoin scene here in New York, locally, right? I mean, y'all
have
BitDevs.
Yeah, we're really lucky. We have a great scene here.
Yeah. How much does that play into things for you? Like having actual people you can go.
It's huge. It's like a support group.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, you know, well, we have the blockchain week that they come and inundate us.
Sure, sure.
Every, you know, once a year, which like kind of sucks, but it's nice that people come in. But I like met up with my New York City Bitcoin crew during that. And I mean, this was like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. We had gone from like a 3 week period. We had gone from like 6K
yeah.
to like 9K or like 8.5K.
Yeah.
And all these guys, I'd been meeting up with them, you know, like twice a month during the bear market. So like we meet up with each other, we're like, wow, we're rich again.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's like, I don't know, it's just an amazing community. Yeah. And I'm amazed that, you know, BitDevs is probably one of the best meetups in the world for Bitcoin. I go to that, you know, that's once a month. It's run by the Chain Code guys.
Mm-hmm.
I go to that. Half the shit, I have no idea what they're talking about.
Right. You okay.
know?
Sure.
But then we get drinks afterwards and there's beer there and there's, you know, they get pizza brought in and it's fantastic. It's just like a beautiful community. Pierre has done a fantastic job, also like coordinating events, and he has a monthly meetup that is awesome. And just as a New Yorker, I am amazed because, you know, I was a New York Bitcoiner when Ben Lawsky was passing the draconian bit license on us, and I saw that happening, and I was like, New York is fucked. Like, we are not going to get any kind of action on the Bitcoin side. And I was wrong. Somehow New York persevered, you know, even with, I did not expect us to have such a strong community with the bit license.
Yeah. So how long have you been in New York? Have you always lived in New York?
Yeah.
So you were here on 9/11 or when?
Yeah.
We went to the 9/11 memorial today.
Yeah.
That's heavy.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, I was in middle school.
Yeah. I was in high school. I remember. From where I was at in Texas, but it's not the same as living it here, man. That's
It's pretty crazy.
It's crazy. Sorry, I didn't mean to get super
heavy on you. No, yeah, no worries. I think that like shaped a lot of, you know, of how I grew as a person as well.
Yeah. So kind of back to the community and things like, it's important to have community because we've got a little meetup where I live. I mean, me and the guy that told me about Bitcoin started it. And there's a few guys there, but, if for anybody out there who doesn't have any kind of meetup or something, like try and find people in your area or start one, because it is important to have that in real life. I think, it's kind of goofy. On the plane today, I was watching Ready Player One. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
did you read the book?
I read the book. It was different. It's definitely different. I think
the movie was way worse.
You think so?
I think so. Yeah.
I think I liked in the book how much more they went into detail on like the challenges and things.
Right.
And that it was more specific to the 80s. I think the movie is just kind of like generic pop culture. So that was a little weaker. But what I liked about the movie, and I didn't remember, and maybe this was in the book and I just forgot, but spoiler, sorry, if you guys haven't seen it, it was a late spoiler warning,
yeah,
whatever.
You give spoilers on.
But the kind of that emphasis on like real people connection.
Right.
I like that. And so like I kind of was watching.
You're meeting your internet friends in real life.
Right, right.
Like so we're doing right now.
Right. That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, so that's what I was thinking about when it happened. And I was thinking about like, spoilers. So, you know, if you don't want it ruined, skip ahead or whatever. But towards the end when all the people show up and kind of stand in the way for a brief second and then they all part, whatever. But, when they stand in the way, and I was just thinking like, I think that's coming for us, like at some point for Bitcoiners, like that might happen. Or, And I guess in a way, to some extent, like I was thinking about like Hodlanaut and some of that kind of stuff and just like...
Yeah, Bitcoin is stick together.
Yeah.
We need to stick together. Everyone's out to get us.
Right.
You know, I don't think that's paranoia. I think they are.
Yeah, I think they are. And I think we need to stick together and give a lot of grace when people hurt your feelings. Like, we got more important stuff than...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know. Bitcoin Twitter is fantastic in that it does connect a bunch of us from around the world with similar interests, and that allows us to then, you know, put faces to names when we, you know, also meet around the world, right?
Right.
You know, one of the things that's nice about, but it goes, you know, but at the same time, like, the best OPSEC would be if no one in real life knew
yeah,
any
true.
Bitcoin. But since I've loosened my OPSEC, it has paid dividends in that respect, that I've met so many great Bitcoiners.
Yeah.
And that, like, since they know I'm in New York, when they come, like, you're here now, they reach out, you
right.
know, which makes it really easy for me, right? Because I'm already here. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely a balance, and Bitcoiners definitely need to stick together, because, I think we haven't seen anything yet. I think it's going to get, the attacks will get worse before they get better.
Yeah.
I think the attacks have been kind of lame up until this point,
right.
to be honest.
Right. We're not extending any particular challenges, but yeah, they haven't.
Yeah.
The heat hasn't been very real yet.
They've been poorly executed.
Yeah. So, are you going to Bitblock Boom?
Yeah, I will be at Bitblock
awesome.
Boom.
Yeah.
That's like another issue with like the whole OPSEC thing, right? Is that, it's like conferences and stuff is I think you're like most vulnerable when you travel in general.
Yeah.
Like we were talking about the TSA and you have like no rights.
Well, being here is very different, because like at home, I'm from Texas, like we can carry guns or you got to have a license, right? But I can carry my knife on me all the time.
Right.
I do at work. It's a tool. It's not just for like defense. It's like I open crap with it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But here, well, even just getting on the plane and like being here, it feels weird to not have my knife
right
in my pocket.
Exactly. It's hard to transport it with you here and whatnot. Yeah, no, absolutely, 100%. But I'm excited to go to Bitblock Boom. We're gonna do a live rabbit hole recap.
Oh,
over
nice
there. Yeah,
that's exciting.
I'm excited to go to the Nakamoto dinner.
Yes,
so that should be a good time.
Cool.
I've been looking forward to meeting our Texas crew.
Yeah, there is a crew. They're just mostly in Austin and Dallas, so I have to drive a ways to get there.
But yeah, if I could live I'd probably be living in Austin. I just have a nice fiat job here, so that's why I'm still in New York.
Yeah.
I'm in accumulation mode until Bitcoin delivers me to early retirement / podcast host.
Nice. So I was just thinking about this, about moving, and then thinking about places that would be more friendly to Bitcoiners or not. I don't know much about it, but what are your thoughts on the stuff that Caitlin Long's doing? Is it Wyoming?
Well, I would never move to Wyoming.
Yeah, it's do they have internet there?
I don't know. We don't need like Bitcoin specific regs or anything.
I don't think we need it. I'm just asking, do you think it's helpful?
I guess, you know, good regs are better than bad regs. I'm not going to spend any time on it. The states that I'm looking at are like, if I was going to stay in the states, are the states that respect personal rights in the first place. Places like New Hampshire, right? That they're already libertarian states to begin with. It doesn't matter what their specific rules are in terms of cryptocurrency.
Right.
Bitcoin is just money. Like, I don't, that's like a separate, you know, I don't think that we necessarily need these places to specifically woo Bitcoiners. They just have to not be against Bitcoiners.
Yeah.
And then they're, they're possible destinations for me. But I also think like I could, you know, well, it depends how America handles this, but I could easily see me not living in America in the future.
Sure.
But you know, we'll play that one by ear.
Yeah.
But I do think, I think that a world where Bitcoin is successful is a world where countries start competing for people way more than they are today.
Yeah.
Because it takes away their monopoly power on the actual financial system.
Yeah. Cool. All right. We're at an hour and a half here.
Should I wrap it up?
Yeah, we should probably wrap it up. So how can we, or you got anything else like immediately planned, or just keep doing what you're doing?
Well, I'm glad I got final message out of the door. I was anxious about that, so that's good. You know, we're trying to scale up the podcast. We're trying to do some interesting things there. We got, you know, like microtransactions with Lightning.
The new website's nice.
Thanks. It's been like a long time coming. We just did our first round of merch. You know, maybe we'll do some more merch. You know, we just want to provide like solid content.
Yeah.
Love our fans. They're just, Bitcoiners are fucking the best.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just really excited about Lightning. You know, we have our Lightning node that's run by an undisclosed fan now. And, it's running through Tor, and it's like one of the largest Tor Lightning nodes. And like, that's like the best way to learn. Just like push the envelope, like have skin in the game, and like be a, just, you know, just be a good example.
Yeah.
For everyone else. And I'm just going to keep on hustling. And hopefully by the next bull market, I can be full-time Bitcoin and not, you know, with my day job that I...
Yeah, that'd be cool.
My day job literally at this point is just, it's like, if in my mind, it feels like my side job.
Right.
And like Bitcoin is my full-time job. Yeah. So I just need to make that actual practice, and that'll be the next step.
Cool, man. Where can we keep up with you?
Twitter. It's just all Twitter. Matt_Odell.
Okay.
Our podcast is Tales from the Crypt. You can search that on your favorite podcast app. That website we just talked about is tftc.io. I like the .ios. See?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. And you guys are on Ellencast now.
Yeah. So the guy, DJ Seeds, who did up our website for us, created Ellencasts.
Yeah.
And so we're the first podcast that he's working with. Are you gonna go on it?
I'm on it now. I just like 2 days ago or whatever, I was up late and I was figuring out all, you know, connecting my node and everything to it, and DMing him on Twitter, and he helped me out. He's
pretty
great.
Slick. Yeah. So I just like things like that. I think that, you know, I don't like to call it, you know, Marty likes calling us a Bitcoin lifestyle brand. I don't like calling us news. But I think that like publications in the space and companies in the space, like they should be trying to push the envelope on new monetization models,
for sure.
New, you know, and I think it's a lost opportunity when they don't. And I like to see, you know, I think with the grassroots podcast, we're fortunately in Bitcoin to have all these strong grassroots podcasts, all these small podcasts that are very strong. And stuff like Ellencast really pushes the envelope. Like, we're not, you know, changing the world with our 10-cent...
Right.
Our 10-cent per listen Lightning podcast, but there's something there. And it's... When you do a Lightning microtransaction, it really does feel tangibly UX-wise. It feels right.
Yes.
Even though, like, it's still rough around the edges, but it feels, like, pretty point and click.
Right. And you can... You know, so like the way it works, if you guys haven't used it yet, you go to .com.
I think it's ellencast.com.
And then you can pick your podcast and you go down and you pick your, like you pick an episode and you go down and then you pay for it. And then it opens up and lets you listen to it.
And it goes straight to the creator. It's non-custodial.
It's non-custodial. So, as a creator, you've got to, you connect your Lightning node to it. And what's cool about that is even if like, okay, so I did this the other day. I listened to the episode, the Tales from the Crypt, where he interviewed Andrew Torba, and I liked that. So I went on, okay, I'm not going to re-listen to the whole thing, but I already listened to it. So I'm just, it's basically like tipping for what I already listened to.
Tip jar for the episode.
Yeah. So, or you can, you know, other people may not listen, you know, subscribe that way and listen on a regular basis or whatever, but, you know, so they can pick individual episodes to listen to, but it works either way.
Yeah. I just like the idea of like pushing the envelope, trying new things. I think, you know, we're in a unique position to do that. So I'm looking forward to doing that more.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool. All right, man. Well, I really appreciate your time. This was a lot of fun.
Cheers. It's been my pleasure.
I'll hopefully see you in August.
Yeah, damn right.
All right. hope you guys enjoyed that. That was my interview with Matt Odell. Had a lot of fun doing that up in New York. So anyways, y'all go follow Matt on Twitter at Matt_Odell and check out finalmessage.io. He's got a really cool setup there. And if you're not already listening to Tales from the Crypt and the Rabbit Hole Recap with Matt and Marty Bent, you should be. Shame on you. And it's a really great podcast. Let's see, what else? Obviously, check the show notes. There's links to a bunch of the stuff that we talked about in there, Rise Wallet, as well as some of the multi-sig things. And, you know, if you're wanting to support the show, the best way is to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes, share the episodes with your friends, rate and review it, and, you know, otherwise spread the mind virus. And follow me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC. Sorry I've had to be on hiatus the last, I don't know, month or so. Life got kind of crazy, but I'm back for now at least. And I've got a couple of more episodes and interviews in the works. Make sure you come back next week. I'll be putting out the episode where I interviewed Bitcoin Rabbi about his new kids book, Bitcoin Money. So be sure to check that out. All right, for Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.